Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is February 13th, 2025, and this is episode 501. Got to get used to that big, imposing number. Anyway, you are listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, out here in the Rochester area of New York State. And I'm on the line with the Warner John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Italy. John, how you doing?
I'm good. We had a great day, Catherine and I. We went out to celebrate Valentine's Day a bit early and had suave fish-based food at a suave fish-based restaurant and spoke Italian and just were generally suave beyond our station.
Suave. God damn, yeah. You are so fucking suave. That's my Frank Booth. That's my Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
So today, as a kind of part two or coda or something to the War of 1812, the War Nerd of 1812, John was talking about how we should do something on Tecumseh. And there wouldn't have been enough time for the War of 1812. And it's such a different, as the kids say now, vibes. That war has such different vibes. The story of Tecumseh is actually, it's an amazing story. It's very different from the almost silliness of the War of 1812 and the comic relief. This is serious stuff. And we talked about it after the show and John agreed to do a follow-up episode on Tecumseh. But before we get into the story of Tecumseh, I think because it's such a big story right now, Ukraine and what's happening with the Ukraine war, just a few words about what Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Trump as well were just saying about the Ukraine war. Basically, Hegseth came out yesterday. Now, when he was at Fox News, he was a big supporter of the Ukraine war cause and very public about it. And same with Mike Walls, the national security advisor, were big Ukraine supporters and big foes and opponents publicly of Putin. So people thought, oh, is Trump basically going to go back on his word about ending that war? Well, this Trump is a bit different than 2016. This Trump is a lot more prepared and has done his homework more and kind of knew he was going to retake power at some point. And so Hegseth came out yesterday and basically poured a hard, cold ice bath on the whole Ukraine war cause. Now, as we've been talking about on this show, the Ukraine war has gone terribly for Ukraine and for its sponsors in Washington and Brussels. Since kind of spring 2023 with the Battle of Bakhmut, which was a catastrophic disaster and stupidity by Ukraine to hold out in Bakhmut. And then, of course, the big counteroffensive in 2023, which was a devastating failure. And then since then, it has been, there's been, you know, an ongoing 16-month, ongoing, not-stopping offensive by the Russians just chewing away at Ukraine. But what Hegseth basically came out and said was, the war needs to end. Number two, Ukraine and everybody else needs to give up these false hopes that Ukraine is going to get back its territories lost in 2014. That is to say, really Crimea and then parts of the Donbas. He said that's just folly, and that is preventing us, pretending that is going to happen is preventing us from having any serious, real discussions or negotiations about peace. So we need to get over that illusion. It's not happening. So for America to come out and say that you're not going to gain that back is pretty devastating. And then what he said was, this is a European problem. You know, Trump has said over and over, and there's some truth to this, I have to say.
He said over and over,
this war wouldn't have happened if I was president, right?
And as it's gone on, I think there's been a really, to me anyway, really stunning hawkishness in the Central and Western European elites. And there's never been anything more than a vague, lukewarm endorsement of it in the American polity.
Well, I don't know. It depends what signals you read and from whom. I mean, in the think tank land,
in the opinion pages. But
yeah,
I mean, I've never seen. I mean, I read a lot of comments lists and all that, and I've never seen anybody, even the old boomers who are generally all for war.
Yeah.
The New York Times comment section and the Washington Post comment section, yes, they get intense about it and they start thinking they're Patton in their retirement. But
no, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you're absolutely
nobody
right.
else.
Yeah.
Nobody yeah, else no. outside that world.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think maybe in the first month or two, there was some excitement for it and shock, you know, when people were in shock. But beyond that, no. It was very much a war that mattered to the political elites in this political media elites in this country and in Europe, and that popularity did not filter down much. There was, I think, you could say, like among Democrats and liberals, there was a sense of our team, and definitely on MAGA and the Republican side, It is your team. That's why we don't like this war. That's one of many reasons we don't like this war.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, the other thing Egsett said was that this is a European problem, that Europe needs to solve it, that when there is a ceasefire negotiated, that the peacekeepers will have to come from Europe and non-European countries, and no Americans will participate in it, that it has to be completely separate from NATO. He's very explicit about this. And that any attack on those peacekeepers from Europe cannot and will not trigger Article 5. So you are on your own completely. We are not going to back you up. Now, this has been implicit, I think. Well, my take on it among many is this. Biden always held out the hope that Ukraine would be part of NATO, that the Americans would get more and more involved, and even maybe at some point kind of directly involved. We have special forces, JSOC, CIA. Like, the strategic ambiguity that was the strategy of Biden, that everyone's like, oh, it's so smart. It meant nothing to Putin. It wasn't aimed at Putin. Like, he knew what he was going to do. It was aimed at the Ukrainians to give them the stupidity to fight Russia, right?
Yeah, yeah, and to spend an awful lot of lives and money on U.S. defense materiel, which was to Biden's advantage or whoever constitutes Biden's party, but nobody else much.
I mean, again, there was that Time magazine, one of the very few interviews Biden did in the last 2-3 years of his presidency. That was last spring, and they asked him about the war in Ukraine because it was clearly going so badly compared to what people were promised, that freedom will triumph, democracy will triumph, our weapons, our training will triumph, and the bad guys will lose. And it wasn't going well, and they pointed that out in a question at Time. And Biden had this really, like, one of his, you know, nasty kind of defensive responses. What the hell do you mean it's not going well? We killed 300,000 of them. They've been decimated. The Russians are decimated. I mean, he just laid it out what the war is about for Biden and Washington, killing Russians.
That, I mean, I swear it's like a 1955 return of mentality that they have. Like, the more Russians you kill, the better. Yeah. Why? I thought, you know, the year I was born, people talked that way. I gathered that later. I didn't take part in that conversation because I was like blubbering in a cradle. But I thought it had gone out of fashion to talk that way, and it really hadn't.
I seem to remember there was a scene in Love and Death, the one really good Woody Allen movie, where the Russian, the one that's kind of a take on Russian novels, and he's about to go to this big battle from a War and Peace, from, you know, like in War and Peace against the French. And the Woody Allen character, of course, is too much of a coward, and he's having a discussion with some kind of stoical Russian officer, and he asks him sort of, well, what's the point of this? What's the point? Because they're looking at, you know, huge numbers of columns of troops about to attack each other. And he says, the Russian guy says, if they kill more of us, they win. If we kill more of them, we win. And Woody Allen says, what do you win?
Yeah, I love that movie. I have to admit, I don't like Woody Allen in general, yeah. But I there's one where he's marching to his death, and everybody else is cheerful about it, and he's sort of not cheerful about it because he values his skin. And one of the big open-hearted Russian peasant soldiers says, I remember the village and our dear village idiot. And Woody Allen yes. says, under his giant helmet, what did you do, place?
Place, yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of good ones. So that threw hard, cold water, because every plan, I follow a lot of Ukraine accounts and pro-Ukraine accounts. Some of them are terrible. Some of them are good. And in all of them, from the president on down, was going with the illusion that the Americans, one way or another, backdooring it in some way, the Americans are going to provide security guarantees. Even if they give up land, at least we'll get American security guarantees for the part of Ukraine that hasn't been taken by Russia. And that will then be the staging ground for moving, you know, moving to the next phase of the war later on. It all depend. The whole war effort depended on that delusion. And Biden made sure to keep that strategic ambiguity to keep the Ukrainians fighting. And that rug was just pulled out hard yesterday. Mm. And Trump then yesterday had a phone call, I think it was yesterday, with Putin. And he posted something about it, how they had a great call together. And this, of course, was another, you know, Biden's whole thing was Putin is a thug and a criminal. And he cut off, he just refused to recognize or have any negotiations or any discussions, anything with the Kremlin since the invasion in February 2022. And Trump, on the other hand, called Putin and started working out a peace deal with Putin before even talking to Zelensky. And a reporter asked, do you view Ukraine as an equal member of this peace process? And Trump, if you hear it, it's even more incredible. He says, it's an interesting question. Yeah, he said, and then he said, I think they have to make peace. Their people are being killed. I said that was not a good war to go into, and I think they have to make peace. He's showing openly, more so than before, contempt, his loathing for the Ukraine war cause. And as I've said many times before, as we've said, there's a reason for it, and that is Ukraine played a central role in Russiagate and in the first impeachment. And all right. This is a guy out for vengeance. Not just Trump, but the whole magosphere remembers that. And to add to it, you had NAFO, and the NAFO crowd swarmed the people that are in power right now when they thought, you know, when they were unleashed and they thought, you know, everything was going their way, the NAFO trolls, like from Musk on down, and they engendered so much antipathy because for so many people, their experience with the Ukraine war is online. And then And a lot of that experience, if you're not completely hardcore NAFO, you've probably been trolled by these awful, arrogant people. And you will lose your sympathy for Ukraine. So a lot of things have been done, but more than anything, Ukraine making itself, Ukraine's governing class, very actively making itself a lead participant, a lead actor and agent in Russiagate going back to 2016. And, you know, the criminal case against Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign manager, that was all from Ukraine leaks and help, you know, Serhiy Lyshenko, this freaking anti-corruption grant feeder dweeb, just worked hand in glove with the Democratic Party and Democratic Party aligned
supporters. That's really interesting because I, you know, now that you mention that, that seems absolutely right. And yet, from the American side of things, the Biden administration never looked that strong. It never looked like a good bet.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, there was this sense that is that evaporated in November 2024. There was a sense from 2015-16 after the election, and then after, you know, starting in 2021, even more so, that Trump, again, was some kind of, it was a blip. It was a flaw in the system that would be worked out. It is not systemic, that Trump is nothing American. He's not,
there's nothing real about it.
Yeah, right. That's not who we are. There's nothing real. And people convince themselves. I mean, that's how Russiagate worked so well, because it was like, yeah, of course, this isn't who we are. This was imposed on us by barbarian Asiatic foreigners. And I think the Europeans and people outside believed it even more. And the Ukrainians were the stars of the heroes, you know, from 2016, from, you know, in the Democratic Party side from 2016 up through the loss, you know, November of last year. They were front center stars. They were the belle of the ball, at least until October 7th, among the Democratic Party in Washington, they were the belle of the ball. Then October 7th happened and they had to go. Then everyone went dark, you know.
Yeah, I wonder how much political capital got spent on supporting Netanyahu that drained from the Ukrainian cause.
Absolutely, yeah. And the Ukrainians knew it and complained about it. But they understood then that it was in very harsh terms. Like, again, Biden would never come out and say this, but it was very clear the difference between the American support for Israel versus the support for Ukraine, which was huge. I mean, a non-NATO, you know, non-tight ally had never received the level of aid that Ukraine had gotten. But Americans got directly involved in defending Israel. Our ships and our air force defended them from missiles, and we have special forces in there, and we're doing all kinds of intelligence and shipping them every bomb, every Patriot, everything they need, they get. And Ukraine doesn't get everything they need. They get a lot of the scrap, you know. It's like, it's a Bradley, but it's a shitty Bradley. It's an Abrams, but it's one of the ones that's been mothballed, you know. And they understood, I think it was hitting them hard kind of then, just as the war, it was hitting them how badly the war was going, that we now see what America really does for its, the allies it considers vital, and then the ones like us, it considers proxies. And there's a big difference. And Trump has just, I mean, it's consistent with the Trumpian America first, Hobbesian worldview philosophy to ditch Ukraine and this whole like, oh, we fight for democracy. No, you fight for interests. And more to that point, Trump came out also and said, it was either yesterday or the day before, to add to the shock that the whole Ukraine crowd and pro-Ukraine war crowd has felt. He said, he made it very ambiguous how he said this. He said, he was kind of saying, you know, we want $500 billion of natural resources, and Ukraine's got a lot of resources, and we, you know, we could get them and we'll give them aid for that. But then he changed his language some, and we can talk about this when we get more into all this next week, where he was actually saying, we've already given them hundreds of billions of dollars and they owe us $500 billion in resources. What he was really, what he's going into this negotiate, he's kind of negotiating down Ukraine. He wants out of this war. He hates the Ukraine cause, as does MAGA. He wants Ukraine to sign a surrender deal and to pay America from what it has left, $500 billion for what America gave it.
Is that realistic? Is Ukraine going to get that money?
Ukraine does have, I mean, you know, it could be realistic if you were going to, if you were going to turn all of them into, I mean, set them back 1,000 years, you know, and sell everything. They do have a lot of natural resources. They do have some valuable industry. Most of it is already under Russian control. Some of it, some of the really valuable stuff, like the coking coal plants, mines and plants, Russia's already, Russia's like within a couple kilometers of that. It's outside of Pokrovsk. And another big deal thing is their lithium mines, which, you know, lithium in the EV age has now worth a lot. But Russia is about 4 miles away from taking the largest lithium mine. So a lot of the point is a lot of their resources are already under Russian control. And I don't know how Ukraine could pay for it unless it was like on a 50 or 100 year payback. I don't want to say anything, predict anything with Trump, but I can't imagine Ukraine would be forced to pay that. What it seems to me is Trump going in and playing hardball with Ukraine, which really means playing hardball with the Europeans and with the faction of the U.S., you know, national security state or deep state that is still deeply invested in that cause, so that when he doesn't demand that or lowers it massively or whatever, you know, it's a concession.
Right. That's what's really stunning about this moment for me anyway, about the people who've gone in with both feet on the Biden agenda, and especially the Ukraine part of the Biden agenda, because really the other foreign policy exploit, the Israel loyalty, is very, very bipartisan. But Ukraine is mostly the Democrats, and they are so irrelevant now that it's amazing they didn't plan for that. Or it's almost as if they really have lost their heads and they don't have any plans.
It's amazing also that they just shamelessly roped Ukraine into this.
Yeah.
Because Ukraine's fortunes were completely contingent on one side. And Ukraine made out more or less okay in the first Trump term. So maybe they thought it would be more or less like that in the second Trump. This things are very different this time. Mm. Trump was, you know, under just massive assault from so many power centers during his first term. And he himself was very chaotic. And, you know, it was a very unprepared presidency. So not a lot was done or changed. This time it's very different. And he's, you know, it was really stupid of Ukraine's governing class to throw in completely with the Democrats and with the European governing classes. They all thought that this was just, this is an aberration. This is like catching a flu and you know, we'll expel that virus. I think what happened in November was, it's just left them completely stunned and incapable of action, and having to face the fact that they got everything wrong. And Ukraine is the first major victim of that, because Ukraine was weak, but was recruited into, you know, front and center role in Russiagate and the hero of liberal world order and all that stuff, which has been rejected. It's just not popular outside their circles. It's just not.
No. And the hero generally dies.
Yeah.
And they don't have people to spare. This is not some European country in 1914 when their birth rates were through the roof. They exempted people under 20 from the draft for a reason, because there aren't that many of them. And there are a lot fewer now.
Under 25 were exempt.
Yeah.
It's, their demographics are awful. Their morale is really low, and it's gonna. This is gonna filter down. Their morale is gonna take a huge hit. Like, I'm telling you, the I've never seen. You know, I've been following this since 2013, 14, since Maidan started. Well, I've been following all this, for much of my adult life. But I have never seen the pro-Ukraine crowd and the pro-Ukraine war crowd, even with bad defeats and a lot of bad news over the last 2 years, nothing like the reaction, the hard, cold reality water, ice cold thrown on them yesterday and their reactions to it. It was just an absolute gut punch. And they know there is nowhere to turn. This is, and all of this cant about when people said, the problem was holding out this possibility and moving towards this future of Ukraine joining NATO is going to bring the war. And then it brought the war. And everyone said, well, what about Ukrainian agency? What about what Ukrainians want? Listen to Ukrainian voices. If Ukrainians want it, why should Russia be able to tell them that? It's like, it's never been about what Ukraine wants. It's what America wants. And this is one thing that was so clear yesterday. NATO is not about other countries' agency. It is only about what Washington wants and doesn't want, period. NATO serves the American empire, period. This was a harsh day for that crowd. And you had war boosters like Michael McFaul and stuff. They all think they're going to shame in some weird universe, shame Trump. Like, you're supposed to know the art of the deal, and you just gave away the house by already saying, that you're going to cut a deal and you're not going to give Ukraine NATO. Like, aren't you supposed to negotiate that away first? Aren't you supposed to negotiate away, losing the 2014 borders? You already gave it away. What kind of negotiator are you? It's like, no. Trump is throwing this overboard because this is your war, and this war was aimed at, and all the disinformation NGOs and all the, we have to fact check, everything was aimed at stopping Trump, and that's what he is dismantling now. And the Ukraine war was sort of the peak of all that, and it's all being dismantled because he's in power. And
what you said about Trump regarding Ukraine as one of the items on his vengeance list makes perfect sense. And it's all the more amazing that, nobody in whatever passes for the Democratic brain trust wasn't thinking about that. Or perhaps they didn't care either. They were willing to gamble a little with Ukraine and let the tens of thousands of people who died there die because it was far away and it was useful to them, at least for the moment.
Yeah, the kind of two leaders in the House, the Democratic leaders, one is Hakeem Jeffries, and he's been going around giving interviews saying, what can we do? We can't do anything.
Yeah.
What can we do? And going to like Silicon Valley and saying, what do we got to do to get you guys to give us money? What? Tell us what to say and do. How far do we have to move MAGA word and we'll do it? Just, we want your money. And the guy who's supposed to be kind of put in charge of like hearings for if the Democrats are trying to rally for hearings is Representative Jerry Connolly, who is dying of terminal throat cancer. He's in his mid-70s and he's literally dying right now.
Wow.
And that's, they deliberately set it up to lose. That's where they're at.
I don't think it's much better across the water, because there was a really disgusting story yesterday from the British Parliament about the government apologizing massively and swearing they would fix the problem because a lot of Palestinians were admitted to refugee status in the UK.
Jesus.
And they swore this would never happen again.
Wow.
And this is a Labour government doing this.
Yeah.
And it's quite a shock.
Base times. There's that line, and we'll get to Tecumseh, but I always remember this line that Solzhenitsyn quotes in, I think it's August 1914 or one of those Red Wheel books. He quotes a Russian poet. It's something like, times were worse, but never baser.
Yeah.
And it definitely feels that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's get out of the wretched present and go back a couple hundred years to the story of Tecumseh. John, where do you want to begin?
Well, Tecumseh is hard to introduce in a strange way because there's a lot of context that you really have to deal with. The American frontier is an old idea, but it's it more or less after the Revolutionary War was officially the ridgeline of the Appalachians. There were reasons for that, like European statecraft. The British had links to the Iroquois in particular, but other Indian groups that were hunting, and especially hunting the last of the American beavers in the forests of what was then the Northwest. Northwest means in late 18th century, early 20th century, in the American sense, everything between the Great Lakes and the Appalachian Mountains. So they wanted that for a lot of geopolitical reasons that, you know, actually remind me how well they did geopolitics compared to certain other people that we could name. But they wanted to keep a place for their Native American allies. They wanted to keep extracting the very, very lucrative fur trade out of this region that was, by all accounts, an extraordinary place. Like, I always knew it was a hardwood forest of oak-like trees, but we're talking oak-like trees that half a dozen men could only span around all with their arms extended. I mean, massive, massive trees. And that was all going to go away and become farmland eventually, but not yet. A lot of people had their eyes on this land, obviously, and a lot of people who were close to the American elite after the Revolution. But this developed only through a long, long series of wars, and there's a good lesson in how irregular warfare progresses and develops in these wars. There's a lot of detail, and you can't really do it all in the time we have here. I'm going to give more extended written versions of this to our subscribers after this show. But basically, we're talking about the mid 18th century to 1815, basically, a sort of 60 years war, which I called out in an earlier article, a long series of little wars that amounted to one big war between white invaders and red defenders over what they called the Northwest. I mean, Northwest now, I guess, means Seattle.
Yeah.
But back then, it was inland of the Appalachians, but stopping at the Mississippi.
Right.
And these were very nasty, bloody wars in which there were generally no prisoners taken on any sides. They tended to involve the British and the French in their relationship with their client tribes early on, but they developed between the American colonists and various tribes after that. The leadership of the revolution, including above all George Washington, was part of the hierarchy of the British force in the early versions of the early part of this war that was fought in land that would be fought over again and again and again. The Braddock Expedition, I don't know if people have seen the painting, but there's a very famous painting of a British officer in that classic 18th century uniform sprawled face up in the back of a gun carriage being carried along in defeat. And he's, you know, he's clearly got an abdominal wound. Mm. That was Braddock, General Braddock, a pretty terrible British general. And he was defeated by a force of French and Indians in the summer of 1755. And if you've seen The Last of the Mohicans, you've seen a pretty good dramatized version of that battle, which was basically the British are marching along in their red uniforms. And by the way, the British didn't always act this dumb, not by any means, but Braddock did. And the British are marching along with their fifes and their drums and their British and their red uniforms. And the French and Indians are skulking along in the forest on either side of the trail. And then they start shooting and they just shoot into the columns and the British form up for a while and point useless volleys at the woods. And after they fired, because, you know, you get one shot with an 18th century musket, then they come in whooping and scalping. And that was pretty much how it actually happened. The French were defending Fort Duquesne. They decided, and especially they decided on the part of the younger officers, like, we don't want to do it that way. We've learned a lot from our allies here, and it would be much better to just lay an ambush for this column as it approaches the fort. And they did. And the casualties by local standards, because, you know, there's still a pretty small colonial population, is more than 500 killed, including all of the 50 women and children who accompanied the column. The French and Indian casualties were maybe 24. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Wow.
And this leads to one of the truisms of this war, as long as it's part of the global war being waged between Britain and France at the time. And it was a global war. There are battles, especially naval battles, all over.
Yeah, sometimes they call it the First World War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really was. The French lost. Almost inevitably, they just sort of took their eye off the ball and lost or started, you know, it was like, fight amongst yourselves. But they had some remarkable triumphs there. They never invested as much in their North American colonies, partly because they didn't have any of the good land in the first place. You know, you're in the 18th century, you got those crummy shoes and those crummy hats. You don't want to be in Montreal in January. I mean, New York, I gather, is bad enough right now, but Montreal, no.
They wanted what mattered more to them were the islands that produced sugar and whatever else.
Those little islands that looked like dots on the map, but they coined money.
They're like giant Bitcoin farms.
actually. So Braddock was defeated, and the French still controlled, and that meant that they and their Native American allies controlled the inland Northwest. And if you were a land speculator, like a lot of Washington's friends were, and by the way, William Hoagland, guest on the show many times, has written a series of excellent books about this little-known side of the early American experience. And he stresses to what extent the proto-American elite was conscious of the value of the land in this territory, even though they didn't have it yet. At the end of the American Revolutionary War, the American government signed a deal that said basically, you're going to stay out of this. The ridgeline of the Appalachians is as far as your territory extends. But nobody, as far as I can tell, really believed in that. You had a bunch of colonists who were spreading out from Virginia in particular because they dealt with a Virginia elite that was already incredibly snotty and already had possession of almost all of the land and was rapidly converting it into large slave plantations. And they felt that their best chance was to deal with the very rich land over the Appalachians, because this was land that was washed by the floods of gigantic rivers, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio. Mm. And they knew that once you cut the trees down, you could farm these places forever. These people, in their folksy way, knew a lot about soil. Mm. And the topsoil was like 10 feet deep in a lot of this river valley. And that you don't get that very often.
Yeah.
So there was money to be made here. The French and Indian War, as it was called in North America, but basically the France-Britain Global War, went from 1754 to 1763. Britain basically won. Canada became British. The United States at that time was still British and would remain officially so, though at war over the issue of being British, till near the end of the 18th century. But the wars had already begun because the French were gone. And even though they were a kind of dangerous and treacherous protection for the northeastern tribes, when they were gone, it made a difference. There were no protections for some tribes. There were immediate wars in parts of what was then the Northwest, that is what's now the Great Lakes area. In 1763, Pontiac's War, Indian allies of the French, who had been allies of the French, launched a war against the British because basically they'd backed the wrong global power. There are a lot of echoes in all this of, you know, what you do when you're trying to handle superpowers who are fighting, or even what you do when the aliens land. And basically, my cheerful conclusion is there are no good options when the aliens land.
That's one thing that's come through, I think, in many wars we've covered, historical and sometimes current, on this show over 500 episodes. Sometimes there are no good options.
Yep.
You might last longer, you might hold out longer, you might get a less horrible deal, or there's no escape from any horrible deal.
Yeah. Because, I mean, a lot of people in this kind of war want to wipe you out because it's not a dynastic war of the sort the Europeans often fought. It's more of a war that the Romans would have fought. And very often the Romans just decided, these people are a nuisance. We just need to get rid of them. And that happened again and again. Into this chaotic world, Tecumseh is born in sometime around 1768. Tecumseh is a Shawnee. They had originally been part of the southeastern United States as it is now. They had been forced west of the Appalachian Mountains by a settlement in Georgia and Virginia and the Carolinas. His name, which some people took as an omen, it means something like the shooting star or the panther in the night sky. So it's a very omen-filled name, and it's like that kid's going to amount to something. he also amounted to something because he was in an important family in the Shawnee. He grew up west of the mountains, and he grew up with a grudge, sort of like Hannibal grew up with a grudge. There's a great story. I have loved this story probably for reasons which speak ill of me since I was a little kid. When Hannibal is a small child, his father takes him into some kind of sacred grotto or something and says, "Swear that you will take revenge on the Romans with your last blood." And he says, "Okay, Dad, that sounds great." that's how he becomes Hannibal.
That's pretty cool, though. You get a quest for life from that.
Real quest. Oh, yeah. It's
every boy's dream.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
Especially because he loses. That's the best part of it. I don't know why, but as Ray Midge says in Dog of the South, I spent all my time thinking about Hannibal and Lee, both defeated, it occurs to me.
Yes.
So he and his brother become very important to the Shawnee people. We're talking about a people who may amount only to a few thousand, but that's because we need to talk here about the depopulation of the Americas. This is something that's only been really clear in the last few decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't know this when I was growing up, but I don't know if they were saying it in your time.
They were starting to, yeah, because there was a brief period where Indian lives matter, right? There was that period in the 70s where American Indian, Native American, they were the object of left-wing white America and cult, and Hollywood and hippies and everybody. They were the heroes. And they were, like the Black Panthers, they were eventually crushed. I mean, they had their own militant movement. But yeah, they were heroes. And so because of that, we knew that they were displaced. We knew they were massacred, but not the scale of the depopulation.
Right.
You're right. Not the scale of it, which is...
No, because I think, just to give the numbers first, 1492, when Columbus arrives, how many people were in the Americas? The best guess that the demographers make now is more than 60 million. And what is much more clear is that it dropped like a giant rock. Yeah. A century later, there were only 6 million.
God.
And there were many massacres, trade wars and other wars, but overwhelmingly it was a matter of disease. Mm-hmm. The population that had crossed from Siberia or the populations at different times were relatively small. They had not encountered the viral soup that Europe had been swimming in for generations. I mean, when the Silk Road was opened, viruses had free passage guaranteed to every little flea or whatever
hyperloop
cared to come along.
It was hyperloop for bubonic plague.
Although the people who died of the plague, which was one of the more horrible diseases of all time, although they probably didn't see it, you could have gone up to them and said, "Hey, you awake? Hey, listen, this will pay off in demographic terms when you go to the Americas."
Yeah, thank you.
So there were only 6 million Native American peoples all through the North and South American continents. So the tribes were not big. And especially the the North American tribes were not big because they tended to be smaller than the groups in Central and South America. It was pretty cold to live in most of the time. But there were a few thousand Shawnee. And Tecumseh and his brother were two of the most important figures in the Shawnee tribe. His brother was known as a witch finder. And this, to me, is one of the most interesting things about Native American culture in the wake of the European arrival, because it really reminds me of what I'm pretty sure will happen if the aliens ever come. How do you make sense of this? Mm. How do you make sense of this thing that has landed on us? There's this cool science fiction story I always loved that a giant lizard just lands on the Earth from God knows where. And hundreds of millions of people are killed. The rest of the planet has to decide what to do about it. Most of them decide to worship it. A few ethnic groups decide to hate it and resist it. But those are soon destroyed by the ones that decide to worship it. And then it just takes off because, you know, it's a science fiction story and they like imagining weird stuff. Yeah. But what can you do to make sense in your head of this horrible thing that has befallen you? There's a book that came out long ago that I think I've mentioned a few times called Keepers of the Game, which suggests a link between the hunt for the beavers and other fur-bearing mammals and the catastrophe of European colonization, because the Native American tribes of the Northeast decided that the sort of proprietary gods of their world, the mammals, their totem animals, had deserted them or had betrayed them. Mm. I mean, this totem animal thing is not the cool tattoo thing that it, you know, became in 21st century culture. It was a dead serious thing. And it's like, if these animals have betrayed us, let's kill them. And so that's one response.
Because it attracted these murderous aliens, but for the beavers. Yeah. So the beavers themselves had betrayed them. That's interesting. Wow.
So what it speaks to above all is this need to rationalize catastrophe.
Yeah.
And one of the other ways that tribes who'd been affected did this, well, two of the ways are expressed by the two brothers, Tecumseh and his brother. Tecumseh takes the vow of revenge, but his brother, who's more like clergy in whatever that meant in the Shawnee sense, becomes a witch finder because they assume, as every culture would assume in a catastrophe as big as this, that this must be witchcraft. Somebody has cursed us. So he takes a lead role at first in finding witches among the Shawnee. Later, he takes a more dynamic role in the military response. But at first, there's a sort of chaos of massacres. Massacre and counter-massacre. Massacre with a cast of characters that doesn't even figure in the larger histories anymore. And I think it's very much, again, like what would happen if the aliens landed. For example, in 1782, there's something called the Gnadenhütten. I can't speak German, but Gnadenhütten massacre. And it's a very painful story, but typical of what you do when you don't know which of the aliens you go with. The tribes divide among themselves over the fight that's developing between the British and their former American colonists. And this is with the Lenape, who were originally a southeastern tribe, moved to the lakes. The Lenape were starving because they'd been farmers and they'd been kicked out of their land. And they formed a large party to sneak back into a captured village and scrounge some food. But they were captured by American settlers, over 100 of them. So over 100 Lenape men, women, kids were tied up, stunned with mallets, and then fatally scalped with tomahawks, because tomahawks were not just an Indian weapon. Both sides used them. I mean, if you've got a one-shot 18th century musket, you shoot that, and then you got to do something close in, and a tomahawk has more striking power than a knife, so you use that.
Right.
The amazing thing is that they went to Gnadenhütten, which is a refuge for some of the German brethren who struck them as the more kindly of the alien invaders. And that was roughly true in many cases. The Germans developed this fearsome reputation in the 20th century, but before that, they had a very, very different reputation as, you know, sort of kind of religious nuts, but also beer-drinking, fun people. And that failed. What actually happened was the United States militia, or the American militia, took a vote, and, you know, everybody got a vote. It was like, do we kill these people? And that passed easily.
It's like that scene in Casino. I don't know. Yeah. Why take a chance?
Why take a chance? Yeah. This was supposedly ameliorated a bit in the Treaty of Paris, which was 1783, which was between the United States and Britain, Canada, whatever. And that set the boundary between the United States, which was the land east of the Appalachians, and what was ostensibly Indian land to the west of the Appalachians. And there's an interesting cultural artifact, one of the many artifacts that's actually born of Mormonism in the 20th century. Mark, I don't know if you know this guy, Orson Scott Card. He got in some kind of big trouble culturally. He said something wrong about, I don't know, gender politics or something. But he also wrote a lot of novels for adolescents, and some of them were pretty good. Speaker for the Dead was about a war of extinction between humans and aliens. And you can see that coming out of the Mormon imagination, because they take the proto-history of the North American continent very seriously, very wrongly, but very seriously. Mm-hmm. And in his novel, there's a massacre of Native American groups somewhere in this Great Lakes area, the Northwest. And it has a magical effect. No white colonist can go west of the Mississippi. They just can't. You know, it's magic forever. So there's this sense that it would have been nice if that could have happened. But, you know, of course it didn't. And they would be going west for a long, long time. The allies of the British, the Mohawks in particular, were kind of angry about this settlement. He said, you have sold the Indians. And the Mohawks had a right to be angry because they'd fought very, very well for the British. People were just flat out scared of the Iroquois Confederacy. And the Mohawks were the fiercest of all the Iroquois allied nations. So they rose. Many people rose, many tribes and confederations of tribes. But in the beginning, it was piecemeal. It's very hard to organize with your neighbors when the rite of passage in your group, as is the case in many parts of the world, where the rite of passage is when you hit puberty, you go out and kill somebody from the next tribe. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a lion or something, but usually it's a person. And then you can be admitted as a full warrior of this tribe. That kind of makes it hard to ally with other people, but the populations of these tribes was so drastically reduced that they had to form alliances. And that's what finally happened in the Northwest Indian War, which is, as William Hoagland has argued, probably the most important war in forming the American state.
Yeah. Not only that, but I think he argues as well that the desire for land among the elites of the colonists, well, a lot of the colonists, not even just the elites, the desire for land west of the Appalachian was also a big reason for the Revolutionary War, high ideals aside. And then the wars there afterwards were key in forming the state.
Yeah, the state was in large part of a project that Hoagland, for example, has described very well in terms of Washington's plans. I mean, Washington surveyed the area in his youth and conquered some of it in his maturity as a revolutionary commander. But the plans were always long-term. This will be a way for my whole progeny to get rich. So it's a very long-term plan, and it's endorsed at the highest levels of colonial society. The British are not totally enthused about it, but on the other hand, they're not going to lose a lot of sleep over what happens to various native confederations either. So just as the revolution is settled between the U.S. and Britain in 1789, smaller tribes in the Northwest, as they called it, decided, as you do when the aliens seem very strong, okay, we got to make a deal with these people. We lost. The trouble is, not everyone is willing to say that they lost. And other tribes, which are stronger, resented this very much. And there were some reprisals against the tribes who'd given in. Because many of these tribes, like the Shawnee, had already retreated. They crossed the mountains. They hadn't really planned to do that. Their territory was the southeast. They occupy this strange land west of the mountains now, and it's not clear to them that they can retreat anywhere. And in fact, it's not clear that they could have. But in the meantime, all the land designs, all the real estate, and, you know, Coolidge said the business of America is business. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, if you grew up in California, it's more like the business of America is real estate.
Yeah.
I mean, real estate above all. And the United States Army forms as a way of conquering and controlling real estate. Their first campaigns begin almost instantly after America forms around 1790. Luckily for the tribes of the lakes, the country between the Appalachians and the Mississippi, the people they put in charge of their campaigns are not always very good. One of the expeditions they send into the forests west of the Appalachians is this almost comically bad general named Armar. He was a disciple of Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben. And, you know, I don't know, Mark, but if you read those kids' books about the Revolutionary War, you know von Steuben as the Prussian drill master mm-hmm. of Washington's army, right? Mm-hmm. Getting those guys to line up properly and salute and do the drill, which was actually quite useful for some kinds of battle, but sometimes not. And the further west you go, the less useful that kind of battle tends to be. So Harmar's plan was to take 1,300 militia and 353 American regulars, because there were American regulars at this time, though they weren't exactly the later American army, to what was then called Kekionga, Fort Wayne, Indiana now, capital of the Miami Indians. And again, yeah, this is not Miami, Florida. This is Miami in Indiana, which is an interesting name in itself. Indiana, Indians. Mm-hmm. He burned a lot of villages, but then with his very stiff European organization, he was forced to retreat because he didn't have a lot of supplies. The leader of the Miami was Little Turtle, and the leader of the Shawnee, Tecumseh's tribe, was known as Blue Jacket. This is often described as the war of Little Turtle and Blue Jacket. It was a complicated war and a really bloody and messy insurgency and counterinsurgency war. They always get messy. There are not many rules. But at the end, Harmar's expedition was a fiasco. 200 roughly killed. And the Miami also lost maybe a tenth of their warriors. It's interesting in that this was a war between two small populations. Mm-hmm. The colonist population was going to grow and very rapidly, but it hadn't yet. And every loss kind of counted. And as for the Native Americans, every single casualty hurt the people. These are very small populations. They've only maybe begun to recover from the catastrophe, the utter plague of the introduction of European diseases. So to lose a tenth of your warriors, people you've had to raise from infancy mm-hmm. and train them in all your ways and your language and your way of making war, it's a disaster.
Yeah, and they're not thinking in terms of the aggregate of American Indians. They're thinking in terms of each tribe, right? So, and the Shawnee. So you're talking about a decimated tribe that was forced to relocate, which does wonders for mortality and so on. And then, to lose a tenth of that small tribe. So even if the American colonists were not, the Americans were not super numerous, they did operate roughly as an aggregate, rather than,
So 1791, the push of the colonists mm-hmm. westward into the forests gets checked in a massive, massive defeat. As many historians have pointed out, this was a defeat that dwarfed Custer. Custer was just more dramatic because the late 18th century definitely didn't expect to be defeated by any Indians. America had been through the Civil War and was a world power by that point. But in real terms, in terms of the number of casualties, the size of the battle, it was much more important, much bigger battle than what happened to Custer, which was basically just a blundering commander does something stupid and there are consequences. This was a real strategic defeat. Little Turtle, Blue Jacket, and other Delaware or Lenape people join up, which was a massive accomplishment in itself. I mean, you see this when, in another context, Germans or Franks attempt to form a confederation against the Romans. It's like you're going against ancient grudges. that have been carefully nurtured for generations. But they had enough sense to do that. They saw this is a much bigger threat. So they mustered, even from their depleted populations, over 1,000 warriors from many, many different tribes. The Americans also came with about 1,000 soldiers under Arthur St. Clair. The battle was fairly simple. The one thing that most American Indian forces could count on was the power of fear. The colonists were flat out scared of them. And maybe that wasn't fair, but in some cases it was very useful.
Yeah. And also, I mean, these battles, low-level massacres, went on for many, many, many decades. And the Native Americans did get a lot of American, you know, American colonists. There were a lot of killings. There were times when they were reasonably strong, like it was, they were going to lose. And you see it from the larger arc. But when you get down in the nitty-gritty of the battles, it wasn't just a completely defenseless population that got mowed over. There were fights. Right. They fought well, and yeah, and massacred, and the Americans massacred. It's like that book, The First Way of War, is a pretty amazing book. You know, that argues that it's not, you know, the tribe, the three tipped hats and the blue uniforms and marching in columns that's the first way of American war, but it's sneaking into villages, massacring people and frightening them and burning, you know, and taking over their land. That's the first way of war.
And St. Clair was not generally esteemed as a commander. He was stiff and slow, and you couldn't afford to be that way in this kind of war. You had to move, and you had to do things like attacking at dawn. Mm. And that's what this Indian Confederacy did. Attacking his camp at dawn. One of the oldest tricks in the book, but it's still a good trick.
I know.
I mean, that's why the secret police always knock on your door at 3 a.m. Because it's like, you're not in the mood.
Yes. You got to get some sleep.
Yeah. So they attack, and, you know, militia is one of the sacred myths of the American population. But in point of fact, American militias in general, have a really spotty record. Mm-hmm. And especially in reaction to surprise attacks. They haven't been trained to the discipline of holding still and fighting back when somebody swarms the camp, whooping, screaming, mm-hmm. and overrunning everything. So the militia part of St. Clair's force just flees, which is sometimes sensible, but not when you're going up against the people who live in this countryside and who can track you across it, because they're going to get you sooner or later.
Yeah, that's so where it becomes like Evil Dead, where you got in the forest and suddenly the forest is really dangerous, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
the forest was on their side. And so they're lost. Hundreds of soldiers are lost out of this force of roughly 1,000. And basically, the United Confederacy of the Northwest Indians goes through the entire camp killing. And the American force had a lot of camp followers, mostly women and children. I think 4 women survived the killing because they aren't armed and they have to take care of the kids. They have no real hope. 630 soldiers out of 1,000 were killed. That is a massive loss for a force of 1,000. Another 250 were wounded. So basically, a few people managed to run away, leaving their women and children to be massacred. Mm. And otherwise, the force was absolutely wiped out. The casualties on the other side, as frequently happens with these sudden dawn raids, very, very light. 21 killed, 40 wounded. So this was for Little Turtle and his friends. It was probably as close as they could get to victory, but the size of the enemy population is just unimaginable to a group that maybe has a couple of thousand people in total. The size of Philadelphia, the size of New York, it's impossible for them to imagine. And what this does in terms of United States state building is promote a regular army, because what a lot of the American oligarchy decides is, and Washington was very much of this opinion, is that you can't depend on militia. Militia just breaks and runs whenever they get scared. You need a new professional army. And after they've humiliated General St. Clair, they demote him to territorial governor and no more military for him. They appoint Anthony Wayne, who's a really interesting, strange character who's been discussed at length by Bill Hoagland to develop a new professional army. And in that way, and this is part of the sad irony of meeting the aliens, like you think you're striking a decisive blow. You blow up the alien spaceship in the sky, like the end of Independence Day. And then you all get around and celebrate, you know, with, what's that other Bill guy?
Bill Pullman, or is it?
Bill Pullman, your Clinton-esque president saying, you know, today's our Independence Day. But no, they just send another fleet that's, you know, 200 zillion massive spaceships.
Yeah. And it's like the credits roll, and you think it's the end, but actually after the credits roll, then 2,000 ships come. It's like, the credits don't roll in this world.
By the way, we have fixed that computer glitch that you exploited, and then you're gone. There's actually a good science fiction book on that, and science fiction does a good job of imagining these things. There's a good science fiction book by Thomas Disch, D-I-S-C-H, called The Genocides. And it was written, I think, in the early 1960s. And it imagines a very different kind of extinction for humanity, in which you never even meet the creatures that have decided to turn Earth into basically a farm field. People are just an agricultural pest, and they never know who has decided to colonize the earth. It's just that suddenly most humans are dead, and the earth has been planted like a cornfield with these enormous crops, and they end up walking around inside the crops, you know, inside the little vascular passages of these giant plants, reminiscing about Marilyn Monroe and, you know, milkshakes. Because they know they're the last of the species.
It's like aphids stuck in, like, I don't know, Eisenhower's time, huh? In Happy Days. Aphids in Happy Days.
That would have been a great episode, if only they had the nerve to do that.
Yeah.
So at some point, we should probably talk about the formation of the American Army. That should be a topic, but, you know, not immediately. But right now, I just thought we should focus on what happens to the west of the mountains, because the British in particular put a lot of hope into Little Turtle and his allies. They don't give him anything that matters. They don't do anything to help him, but they want him to help them. I mean, that's right. Great power logic.
Yep.
And it was a great disaster for the British when the American army began to coalesce and be capable of wiping out the Native American allies who could have been of use to the British.
Right. So this is all sort of in lead up to telling, I mean, this is all basically large background to explain Tecumseh, why he does what he does, and so on. Yeah. And so I think, you know, we've it's gone on and there's so much to talk about Tecumseh. We should probably save that for part two.
Yeah, he's an epic story in himself, and I'm sorry I didn't get to it today, but...
Well, there's too much... there's a lot of background going on. Yeah, there is a lot of background, and you have to know, like, the context that he's working within to make the story make a lot more sense.
In the next episode, we'll get down to the story of Tecumseh and Little Turtle and the other Native American characters in the War of 1812. It's a really tragic story and very much like what Thomas Dish describes in his novel, The Genocides. At some point, the disproportion between you and the invaders is just so great that no human qualities that your leadership may possess can accomplish anything.
Okay. On that happy note, let's end this episode, part one. It's going to be a two-part series on Tecumseh, and we'll come back with part two next week. Thanks again, everybody. And
thanks, everybody.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.